Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we're live at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. With me is the sanctuary's science coordinator, Mark Faraday. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
And of course, we'll be talking birds, but we're going to talk about a whole lot more this morning. We're going to talk about cold stunned turtle season, which is just getting underway. We're going to talk about some of the new space here. You've done the place looks great since last time I was here.
We've done wonderful things with the place, yeah.
This is such a nice, pleasant, you look out the window here, we see the bird feeders, seeing all kinds of activity out here. Tell us what we're, I see a mourning dove, we saw some cardinals, sparrows.
Well, first of all, I'm a little nervous, right? Because I haven't told people at work about this side gig at the radio station. I'm a little concerned they're going to find out. But yeah, this is actually a really nice backdrop here. We've got our newly revamped feeder area, including a children's feeder window here where we're seeing lots of action. Very exciting morning doves.
Yeah.
The morning doves aren't very exciting, but we've had a lot of white-throated sparrows. They're scratching around in the underbrush here. It's very relaxing to watch them.
Yeah.
They're one of the birds that have been undergoing a kind of a range-wide population decline that came out in that recently published report about catastrophic declines in bird population. So it's nice to see them here in normal numbers, scratching around. And they've been singing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know what they sound like. And we don't have Dan here quick on the
that's right
on the on the sound bites, but maybe I can imitate it.
Go ahead.
Melissa can imitate it too. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Go ahead. Just go ahead. Do it. That's pretty good. Oh, we got some school kids coming in. Can you hear them in the background? Here come the kids. So it's an active morning here this morning. If you happen to be in the area, stop in and say hi. We're here until 10 this morning. If you have questions for us, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so we've got all kinds of activity here, but we got on the ponds, we're seeing a lot of the ducks coming in, like there's a wood duck on Mill Pond in East Falmouth. I think there's a Mr. and a Mrs. Wood duck on Mill Pond.
Mr. and Mrs.
That's a bird worth going over there to check out.
A wood duck is a true work of art. I mean, they can be kind of skittish. They're heavily hunted, and they tend to be in these sheltered, kind of swampy ponds. They like ponds with a lot of water lilies on the surface. They blend in really well. They can be hard to find. But when you get a good look at a wood duck, it's like a religious experience. I mean, they're just
beautiful.
Unbelievable. And ducks have these really dense plumages to keep them waterproof, and it makes it for this really crisp patterning, and they just have unbelievable colors. So that's always a good one to find. But yes, this is duck time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the pond ducks are coming in. So you check your local ponds for things like hooded mergansers, which is
one of my favorites.
Absolutely gorgeous. And there's some ponds right around here in East Ham in particular, little nothing tucked away ponds where you can pull up and there's 180 hooded mergansers sitting on the pond there, chasing minnows around. So it's a great time of year for ducks. They're showing up later and later every year, it seems. We have the Cape Cod Bird Club now manages this annual Cape Cod waterfowl census, and it's always the first weekend in December, so that's coming up, but increasingly it feels a little bit early. Mm-hmm. Like that used to be sort of peak time for arriving freshwater waterfowl, and now it just seems like things aren't in yet. There hasn't been a deep freeze up north, because we sort of depend on deep freezes in northern New England to bring ducks to the Cape, where our ponds tend to freeze less often. So that's been happening less and less. But the usuals are coming in. Buffleheads. Everyone loves buffleheads.
Oh, they're so, yeah,
it's
so
like
cute.
Everyone's favorite little duck.
Yep.
And they're coming, they've been coming in over the last couple of weeks. And so they're sort of in. Golden eyes will be showing up now. Mm. Typically the beginning of November is when you see the first golden eyes. They're really nice birds. But yeah, it's time to start checking your local ponds and salt ponds and things, because the ducks are coming in. And the sea ducks have been coming in just by the tens of thousands over the last month or so.
Yeah. What do you think this weather, we're going to get cold. I mean, beautiful this morning, but the temperature is going to start to drop throughout the day. And I hear we could go as low as 9 degrees tonight.
Good God.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that. Yeah, that's brutal. We're going to have people walking for sea turtles tonight.
We're going to get to sea turtles in a little bit.
It was just a teaser.
Yeah.
Don't worry. I was just thinking about that, though. But Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's New England. I mean, you get these abrupt weather changes, and the birds have to be able to deal with that.
And then it bounces back. It's going to bounce back up again. So what does that do for these poor little birds?
It puts stress on them, and they have to, it's all about getting enough food. And so as long as they get enough food to fuel their metabolism through the night, that's what it's all about. And if they can't, they don't wake up the next morning. I mean, that's how nature works. But a lot of these birds are very good at it. You think about chickadees. This little nothing bird weighs as much as a penny or whatever. But they can significantly increase their weight over the course of a single day, and that gets them through a cold night like that.
Mm-hmm. So for folks who haven't been feeding and do like to feed the birds in the colder months, today might be a day they would want to put out their feeders, considering that we're going to get so cold tonight?
Yes. And we've talked about bird feeding before. It's controversial in some circles, but research has definitely shown that it can increase survival of some of these resident kind of suburban birds that visit feeders, things like chickadees and nuthatches and woodpeckers and things like that.
All right. Let's talk to Peter, who's giving us a call from somewhere on the road. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. How you doing?
Great.
Oh, that Peter. Peter Trimble. I've outed you on the air.
All right, so you're out birding this morning, I take it.
What's going on?
I am on my way to bird, yes. So this past weekend, we remembered Vern Locks out on Nantucket. And many of your listeners, of course, remember Vern for doing what Mark is doing now, meeting with
That's
Mindy.
Right.
And his presence was everywhere.
Oh, that's so nice.
So we were out in Mattaquette, which is one of his favorite birding haunts in the fall. And we had lark sparrow, Townsend solitaire, which a few years ago we had as well out there. We had a yellow-bellied flycatcher, which I think might be the second November record.
Wait, what? I didn't see that.
Yeah. You didn't see that? Oh, shoot, I didn't do the e-bird list yet.
Peter's sitting on another rare bird. Boy, some people.
We're about 99% sure, but I need to have I need to figure out how to share it with Trish and Harvey Young and a bunch of others that were with us. We had a beautiful
That's incredible.
Merlin come. Yeah, beautiful
is that,
Merlin come screaming. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
We had a beautiful Merlin come screaming through and sit up on a post and let us approach it so we could get beautiful shots of it in the sunlight, which, of course, the Merlin was one of Vern's favorite birds. Out at Great Point, there was an American avocet found by Blair Perkins that hung around a little bit. That was obviously, you know, a pretty crazy bird to see in November. So it was a wonderful weekend with a lot of Vern's, you know, close friends, Trish Vastuzik, Harvey Young, Megan Savarino, and a bunch of others, Edie Ray, Ginger Andrews, and so forth. So it's just a wonderful remembrance. Visited his little stone memorial down at the harbor, keeping our eyes to the sky.
Peter, I have to tell you, that is such a nice little memorial there, and Harvey took me out to see it. I guess it was sometime after you guys had set that up. He said, "Have you seen Vern's Rock?" And I said, "No." So he took me out there, and when you pull up into that little parking area there, you have to get out of the car and walk around to see the engraving on the other side. And I love Harvey said, "It's like Vern said, you got to get out of the car to see the birds."
Absolutely.
So, Peter, thank you. I didn't make it out there, of course. Again, I really wanted to this year. every year something seems to come up, but I saw the reports, and you guys did good work out there. You did Vern proud. I mean, you guys saw some incredible birds out there.
Yeah.
Yellow-bellied flycatcher, that's crazy. Yeah. You're saying that's not even the latest record for the state? I would have guessed it would be.
I think it's the second for November, Jeremiah would say.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Peter, thanks so much for sharing.
Just one other little one.
Yep.
So I pull into Trish's driveway with Harvey, and Jeremiah comes out to meet us, and Trish comes out to meet us, and we're in the driveway at Trish's on the Mattaquette Road. And Jeremiah's looking over my head. I'm looking towards the house. He's looking out towards the ocean. And he goes, "Red-headed woodpecker." And this red-headed woodpecker flies over all four of us.
Wow.
Just like,
oh, this is just magic. It's magic. So, yeah.
Wow, sounds it. Peter, thanks so much for sharing. We really appreciate that. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So lots of cool stuff happening. I mean, we just heard all that stuff. They saw it on Nantucket. So
they killed it out there. That was on the agenda to talk about today. So thanks to Peter for calling in and giving that firsthand account. I mean, as usual, just an incredible list of birds out there. It's just great to get everybody together like that, and I wish I could have been there, but they always turn up all kinds of crazy things.
What about here, the banding station? We're looking out here at these bird feeders, and we're seeing a good number of these birds have bands on them. And what are we seeing over at the banding station? As you said, we saw a dark-eyed junco this morning.
Yes, the first junco. Mm-hmm. May not have been the first. Apparently, they might have had one a couple of weeks ago, which is very early. But everybody gets excited about the first junco, right? It's sort of a double-edged sword. Like, the first junco. Because that means winter's here.
Yeah.
For some people, it means you stayed too long. I should be in Florida by now. The juncos are here. So they had we'll call it the first junco. I just went over to check on the banders, and they had it in a little cloth bag. They had just taken it out of the net. I've asked them to stop by, but I think they're going to be busy with those school kids that are coming through. And this is one of the great things about the banding station and how much it adds to the programming we can offer to school kids especially. And I don't know how many thousands of school kids come through the banding station every season now.
We'll find out when we talk to Melissa.
We've really ramped it up. And so they get that up-close personal look at bird research, at a bird. They might get an opportunity. We don't promise it, but we might get an opportunity to release a bird or feel it in their hand and feel that little heartbeat, that little warm, feathery nothing, talk about how it's going to fly to South America. And so we're creating spark moments. There's a lot of opportunity to talk about other issues like climate change. Mm-hmm. There's a strong climate change signal in our bird banding data, which goes back to 1929.
Wow.
For many years before this was even an Audubon property. Dr. Oliver Austin, a famous ornithologist back then, basically created his own private bird research station here, 1929 to 1958. And they banded birds all kinds of ways. And we have some of that data. We've been digitizing some of it. Some of our bird banding staff have been doing that. And you just see this clear picture of habitat change and climate change in those birds. There were no Carolina wrens back then. Cardinals were not a breeding bird in Massachusetts back then. They were just starting. Titmice, red-bellied woodpeckers, none. So all of these southern birds that have been moving north were not here yet then.
Wow.
And now they're just every day. We just had a red-bellied woodpecker, and it's just a ho-hum thing. Everybody has them in their backyard. There's one right behind us right now.
Yeah.
And these were southern birds, some of them even when I was a kid, in the 70s and 80s. And so that's one thing that comes out of the bird banding data. But
what a great thing to have, that data going back that far.
Yeah. And it's kind of fun to just look out at the feeders. I point out to people, you can just see naked eye. You can see that these chickadees are almost all banded. The song sparrows that are always under the feeders, they're banded. Most of these white-throated sparrows are banded. And so you can see we're getting a good percentage of these birds. And even as you go around the sanctuary, you can see that a lot of the birds are wearing some bling.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about these little red squirrels. I don't have those in my...
You're obsessed with the red squirrels.
They're so cute.
Enough with the red squirrels.
But where do they... are they just on this end of the Cape? Are they all over the Cape? I've never seen them.
It's one of the things that we have every day and sort of take for granted, kind of like our turkeys that are out here right now.
There's plenty of turkeys around.
Semi-tame turkey. But people come here. This place is for the public, and they come here, and they don't see red squirrels at their house.
Yeah.
They're like, the kids are like all excited about the red squirrel, maybe even a chipmunk, and they get excited about the turkeys. They're so big and ridiculous, and they're right outside the window. But the red squirrels are here because coniferous forest dominates the Outer Cape. And so things like red squirrels and red-breasted nuthatches, which your average person might not get, someone coming from New York or Connecticut or wherever our visitors are coming from, the rest of Massachusetts, they might not have these things in their backyard. So, again, we sort of take them for granted, like, a red squirrel. Mm. But they're really cool.
Yeah, they're very
cute. They have a lot of personality. If you watch them long enough, they'll take on a gray squirrel like nothing, even though they're much smaller.
Well, a lot smaller, yeah.
I actually got charged by one once.
You're kidding.
It was very scary. all 5 ounces of it or whatever.
Wow. But he was ferocious.
Yeah, it was on the bridge out here on one of our trails, and it was on the railing. and he didn't want me to cross the bridge. Oh. And he ran at me.
Wow.
He ran at me along the railing of the bridge. They're very, very feisty, yeah. These red squirrels. There are reports in the literature of them preying on baby rabbits.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
You know, this is one of my pet things that I like to talk about. How don't turn your back on a red squirrel. A lot of these birds, but also fuzzy mammals kind of that you'd expect to see in Bambi, are vicious killers. they'll eat whatever. I mean, we think of them as, you know, eating acorns and spruce cones and things like that. But
they do what they have to do.
They do what they have
to do. All right, 866-999-4626 is the number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're live at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary with Mark Faraday, science coordinator, and we're going to come back and talk about the cold stunned turtle season right after this break. You're listening to The Point, and we are live at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary with Sanctuary Science Coordinator Mark Faraday. And now joining us is Bob Prescott, Sanctuary Director Emeritus. Nice to see you.
Yes, nice to see
you. And of course, you've been working with turtles for forever. Mm-hmm. So this is the beginning. We talked about we're going to get some really cold weather tonight, but we've already over the weekend, what, we have four turtles so far?
Yep.
What have we seen?
We had one green and three ridleys.
And the green
season
was not good.
No, they're pretty fragile. I mean, they nest quite often in Florida, so they're not quite as tropical as we sometimes think, but they're not as robust.
Mm-hmm. So what turtles do we see in cold stunned turtle season?
So almost I think 80-85% are ridleys, mm-hmm. and then a small percentage of loggerheads and greens. And greens are not quite as hardy as the loggerheads.
Mm-hmm. So we have four. Tonight is going to get cold. So this is where people, you know, and you have, I should say, these were not volunteers who found these, right? These were just some people walking on the beach who found them?
A little of both, I think. But yeah, there's a lot of people out there. We've trained a lot of people.
One was a volunteer. Yes.
One was. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So let's say some people happen to be out walking and, you know, what do they do if they come across a turtle?
Yeah, so we do encourage people to go out. We also assign certain beaches and certain tides. But if people are interested and want to go out, they need to, if they do find a turtle, we ask them to move the turtle above the high tide line, cover it with any of the beach debris, tidal wrack, seaweed, and move it above the high tide line, cover it, and then call us. Mm-hmm. And we have a 24-hour hotline, so if they find it after 4:30 or before 9 o'clock in the morning, it will ring to the hotline. It will ring to my phone mostly, but others will have the hotline too. And the number is 508-349-2615, extension 6104.
And we're going to put that up on our website, too, so that people have a link to that.
That'll be great. And you could put the instructions, too, as to what to do, because that starts the healing. You know, the turtles are, right now, the bay, the deep water in the bay is 53 degrees, which is not necessarily fatal. It really, we want the temperatures to be down around 50 before we really see a lot of turtles coming in. But this system that's coming in today is probably very similar to the Thanksgiving system that we had last year. Fortunately, it's coming at a time when the water's a little warmer. Mm-hmm. So, and it's coming before the main part of the stranding season. And if this is the coldest that we get between now and, say, the end of the month, which may be, dreaming. But, if we don't get it cold again, as cold as this, then we'll have more survivors than we had last year. But with the winds predicted at 35 miles an hour, that will push turtles in over the cold water. And the tidal flats get very, very cold. Just as an example, the bay was 54 during the last stranding episode, but the inshore water was anywhere from 37 to 40 degrees. Mm. So even though the bay is warm, the air is cold, it cools the tidal flats off, and that's what gets the turtles.
Yeah, and we should say when you do that, we should mark the spot, right? But when you
you put an X,
thank
you
very much. Put something so that we know we can find them.
Put an X on the beach, or that's what the folks did at out on Great Island when they found it.
Usually there's beach debris, buoys, and things like that. Make it as gaudy as you can so we can find it.
And so what happens to these turtles once you get them? Like the three ridleys that you got, where do they go?
So one was dead and two were alive. So they come into the sanctuary, they're processed. We do the initial assessment to see what condition they're in. If there's any wounds that we can clearly see, then we document those, email the aquarium. And then we call our volunteers who drive them, and then they drive them up to the aquarium.
To New England Aquarium.
New England Aquarium. So the main step is to really get them out of the weather. So, the predicted temperatures over the next 24 to 48 hours are anywhere from from, you know, 48 to 32 degrees. And so that's not a good temperature for a cold-blooded animal to be at. So we, you know, bring them in and keep them at 55 degrees. And when they drive them, they keep them at 55 degrees. Then they go to the aquarium, and the aquarium draws blood. They take a radiograph, an X-ray, to see if they have pneumonia, see if they have any broken bones. One of the turtles that came in had a broken flipper, which is not unusual for young turtles. They, just like young birds, their bones, the cartilaginous caps on the bones aren't completely fused yet. So when they come in the surf, they will snap a flipper. Mm. And it heals, so it's not fatal. And sometimes it has to be operated on, but that's been done. It's quite common. And the turtles can be rehabbed. So the turtles that are up there now are actually swimming, which, you know, a month from now when turtles come in, it's sometimes 3 weeks before they swim.
So the ones that are rescued now have a much better shot at making it than the ones that come in when it gets really cold.
Yeah, absolutely. They could be released in mid-December.
Wow.
You know, if they go to, say, the sea turtle facility on Jekyll Island in Georgia, I mean, it could stay there. That turtle could stay there for a week as it finishes its rehab, and then it would be released. It's still warm enough in Georgia for them to be chipped and then released.
You have questions about the turtles, we'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the things people might walking along, these turtles look dead. And see people go, oh, it's a dead turtle. But don't assume that it's dead, right?
That's right. Oh, yeah. No, we have lots of people, unfortunately, who call us. I shouldn't say lots because most people know what's going on. But we have a number of people who call us at the end of the day and tell us they saw a turtle that morning on their walk. Mm-hmm. And they thought it was dead, and that's why they didn't call us. But almost every turtle is alive, especially this time of year. 90%. Actually, this first round was only 50%, I think. But usually, this one is a little unusual. It's always odd starting, but you know, these next events, you know, 90% of those turtles are going to be alive, 95%. And these are the ones that do the best. Yeah. So we need to get them in. It also helps our record. You know, we need to make sure that we have enough that survive, so we stay in business.
There was one year. What year was that where you just had, there was so many? What
year last was year was a bit of a stunner also. That's not probably not a good word to use, but we had 841 turtles.
Wow.
So when you get tides where you're getting 30 to 50 turtles a tide,
that's
crazy.
A lot of turtles.
But the big year was 2014 when we had 1,241.
Yeah. So when you get something like that, I mean, that you're almost working 24/7.
No, it
right?
is. It's pretty much 24/7 because, as you know, there's a tide during the day and there's a tide at night. So we may not be walking at night, but we're going to walk during the, you know, we're going to have people out on both tides. And so the mornings are the craziest because we have turtles that are, you know, coming in from that night and also from first thing in the morning. You know, we might get a little bit of time off at the end of the day before the next shift starts. So it is 24. Right.
William emails us, a good way to mark the location of turtle strandings would be to use the What Three Words app. Are you familiar with that? What Three Words app?
If it's an app, I have no clue. So,
but people on your staff do, right?
I'm sure they do.
but still mark it, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah. People have sent us, we did get a map of where the turtle was on Great Island because it was in an unusual spot.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the harbor. So there are some Ridleys in the harbor, or greens too, judging by the stranding pattern that just occurred. We had those big southwesterly winds, and it blew, or turtles were carried by the current up into Wellfleet Harbor because we had one on the inside of Great Island, and we had one on South Sunken Meadow Road, which is not, with the way the wind was blowing, it shouldn't have been there, but it was. So to me, it indicates there are some turtles in Wellfleet. We had the same thing last year. We also had the same thing in 2014 with a lot of turtles that went up into Wellfleet. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's a lot of bait fish in Wellfleet, a lot of sori, and some of them are dying, and so the turtles will scavenge that if they're looking for food. There's always obviously a lot of food in Wellfleet Harbor for them, a lot of invertebrates. So some of them are still eating. It's still a little okay for them. They haven't completely shut down.
Something I've been wondering about, I don't know what you think about this, Bob, but, you know, we have this increasing population of smaller great whites that are in the bay. You know, the big ones are on the outside of the Cape feeding on the adult seals. But I would think a Ridley would just be a snack for one of those kind of sub-adult white sharks that are increasingly in the bay. And I wonder if they're getting them before we are.
Yeah, you never know. And their population has recovered. In the very beginning, back in the 70s and 80s, we did a lot of work with URI and their shark researchers. Jack Casey, a well-known shark biologist at the time, was at Woods Hole. And they had a whole program, at University of Rhode Island, they had a whole program of You know, people tagging sharks. At that time, there were a lot of shark tournaments, mm-hmm. and so they were able to get those sharks and open them up and look inside. And the only shark they found turtle remains were the tiger sharks. The oceanic tiger sharks, and in fact, they brought us the carapace and plaster on bones. They didn't realize what they were. They were trying to figure out what fish this was, and it turns out that they were Ridley or small loggerheads. But I think with sharks, as I understand great whites, and this is probably more of a question for Greg Scomo, but they're feeding in the bay. They're feeding mostly on fish because that's what they do, and then they look for blubber, and turtles are definitely not blubbery.
Yeah.
So, but there is an interesting picture that we did get this summer from, I think, one of the Whale Watch naturalists showing a Ridley swimming. It might have been at Stellwagen. It might have been at Jeffrey's Ledge. And there was a blue shark circling this small Ridley. And it looked like, the blue shark's checking it out. But then the Ridley flipped on its side to face the shark. So it made it look like it was bigger. So the shark couldn't open its mouth wide enough to gobble. So you might be right when they're small, and small turtles get eaten by even fish like mahi-mahi, wahoo, sailfish, any of the ocean-going fishes, maybe tuna, anything that fishes under those floating algae mats, they're going to eat the baby turtle.
Blue sharks are relatively wimpy, but I think some of these some of these younger white sharks, that's
maybe
just, like
test
just like a potato chip.
They're
going to
test it. They'll see.
All right, so Bob, why turtles? I mean, there's so many, you have the birds here, there's so many different animals that you work with here at the sanctuary. What is it about turtles? Because it's not just the sea turtles. You also work with the land turtles.
Right. Well, there's plenty of people like Mark and all the other people that are, we're concerned about birds. And so it wasn't a niche it wasn't a niche for me way back then. Plus I don't see very well, I can't hear, so birds are way too fast, I figured I picked something that was slow moving, and so I started with box turtles. And then once I was here and we wanted to build a nature center, and we wanted to understand the sanctuary better, and we sort of asked the question, what were the species that were going to be most impacted by whatever we did here, wherever we built a building or parking lot or trails or whatever was going to happen? And it turned out the most important species and the one that was going to be most heavily impacted was the box turtle. Mm. And we really didn't know that much about them. Where did they live when they were here? What habitats, what parts of the sanctuary? And so that's what started the study of box turtles way back in the late 70s, mm-hmm. and seeing where they were and how they moved around. So that's what started.
I'm jumping ahead here to the spring, but that's when we start seeing some of the land turtles, when we see them, we should not move them too far from where we see. Just take them across the road, and that's it. Don't be bringing them a mile away or anything like that.
Yeah, and even though turtles brumate, they hibernate for the winter, so all the box turtles are asleep and the terrapins are. But as Mark keeps pointing out, our turtle season is really year-round, mm-hmm. because once the stranding season is open, then we go into the necropsy season, which also carries us into March, and then by April, the box turtles are waking up again.
To your point, Mindy, we had somebody, and this kind of thing happens, as Bob knows, somebody just dropped off a box turtle, like a perfectly healthy box turtle. They're like, well, I found this along the bike trail in the National Seashore. They don't all live here. They're not ours.
Yeah.
We're not like the box turtle zoo and you have to bring them back to us. It was fine where it was.
Leave them where they are.
And sometimes they don't tell us exactly where they are, because one of the turtles that we're tracking is actually a turtle that was similar to that story. It was picked up on the side of the road in Truro. That was the note when it went to one of the rehab facilities, found in Truro. Well, Truro is small, but it's not that small.
Oh, my goodness.
And so you can't let it go, just anywhere, and you've got to find the right habitat for them. So we've been tracking that turtle. It's perfectly happy here, but that's not what we want. We want to leave them where they are, because they're happy where they are.
Exactly. All right, so with this beginning here of the cold stun season, do we know why? Is it just because they're caught in Cape Cod Bay? Do we know why they don't just, get out of here
As we know from marine mammal strandings, this area has a magnetic null, meaning that there's a lot of iron in the sand, and it negates any animal's ability to use its electromagnetic sense to see where it's going. So we get gannet wrecks, dovekey wrecks. These are birds that get into the bay and just circle, and they can't figure out how to get around it because they can't see the water on the other side. Dolphins, pilot whales, anything that navigates using their Earth's magnetic field can't figure it out. So that's one of the things that's happening. But the main thing that's happening is the Gulf of Maine is so warm. I mean, 2012 was the warmest year ever recorded in the Gulf of Maine. It may have dipped down a little bit, but it has not. It's not cold like it was in the 1980s and the early 1990s. Mm. So this is really right at the doorstep of climate change. This is one of the things. And as we're seeing with right whales, they're now moving up into, you know, the Gulf of St. Lawrence. We actually had a sea turtle strand in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, you know, Ridley way up there. So everything has shifted north. So the turtles that used to strand in Long Island Sound are now stranding here.
Yeah.
And they're still stranding in Long Island Sound, but not to the numbers that, you know, that we're seeing here.
So are you always looking for volunteers then?
We're always looking for volunteers.
And this is Cape-wide, right?
Not just in this area. Inside the bay.
Inside the bay.
Okay. So you need to be close to, you know, Truro, Wellfleet, Eastham, Orleans, Dennis. Mm-hmm. Those are the main towns where turtles come in. And right now it's hard to tell where they're going to come in, whether it's going to be mostly Dennis Brewster, Brewster Orleans, like it was last year. A couple of years before that, it was Wellfleet Truro. That's where all the activity was.
We have an email here. Are turtles typically stranding at certain areas in Cape Cod Bay, or are they any beaches areas to be vigilant, like Sandy Neck and other Sandwich beaches?
So Sandwich, occasionally, the next storm they're predicting, and it's a little early to really know what the wind is going to do, but they're predicting easterly, so that could be Sandwich. Sandy Neck is patrolled by the Sandy Neck Rangers. We work very closely with them. And they, because it's such a long beach and the way that the tide and the dunes are, they have access and will patrol that on a regular basis. And they go from Scorton Creek to Barnstable Harbor. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much covered. But Dennis, we go at the tide. A high tide is when we schedule volunteers. But once we get into the season, we schedule volunteers to go 2 to 3 hours before the high tide. And we go 2 to 3 hours after the high tide. And we schedule people on the nice days after a major event. These turtles came in after the winds slowed down and actually stopped, mm-hmm. because the turtles get blown in, but then sometimes there's a lag time before they actually, you know, wash up onto the beaches.
Right. Bob Prescott is Director Emeritus here at the Sanctuary. Thanks so much, and keep up the good work.
All right,
thanks so much.
We'll keep going.
And we're
going to
talk more after a quick break. You are listening to The Point. We are live at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, 866-999-4626. If you'd like to chime in with a comment or a question, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With me is Sanctuary Science Coordinator Mark Faraday. And also joining us now is Melissa Lowe, the new Executive Director. Welcome and congratulations on it's not quite so new anymore, right?
Well, no, we're actually still entering week 8.
Week 8, okay.
I'm still counting by weeks, by the way.
All right, so one of the things I noticed as soon as I came in here is this new exhibit space has been really, like, redone. It's beautiful. Lovely job.
The exhibits really are. I mean, they're so welcoming. While I was listening to the show, I was also listening to the backdrop of the... We've incorporated sounds into the exhibits with the video, you know, through the seasons. This video showcases, kind of the sanctuary through the seasons and highlights. And a lot of it, of course, birds, right? Because our sanctuary is focused on birds. So we see shorebirds, and then as it moves into from the fall, then it moves into the winter, we hear owls hooting. And then, you know, into the spring, we hear the bird song, the songbirds. So it's really quite beautiful to have this kind of, this.
It, like you said, it's really peaceful. I was saying that to Mark the other day. I said, you know, I could just imagine sitting here in January and February when it's really not very nice outside, and you know, you get to see all of this wildlife around you, and then just the bird sounds. It's like almost meditative, isn't it?
Absolutely, 100%.
All right, so we were talking about children's programs, and we have some school kids that we saw going through here a little bit earlier. You get a lot of kids through here?
We do have a lot of kids here, and we actually couldn't have planned, I think, this broadcast any better, because today it's actually Harwich 4, grade 4, that's here looking and studying bird adaptations. So they're here on the property. It's part of a curriculum in which they're not just here for a field trip, but we also visit them in the school, and then we follow up with them with other classroom visits, you know, anywhere from 3 to 4 classroom visits and a field trip. So they are out there exploring. They're learning about bird adaptations. They're looking up bird physical characteristics. As Mark said, they get to go visit the banding station, see a bird in the hand. So
it's very exciting.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit about this children's nature trail. That's new, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We have another opportunity here for people to engage. And not only do the local schools have a chance to come out and see our nature trail, which is just outside the grounds here, but we also will have a more of a community space and people to be able to engage in it. We'll have it's already in place, isn't it, Mark? We have the ADA trail for people to access it with strollers, with wheelchairs, and people of all different capabilities. We'll have picnic tables. We're going in two different stages. We have the first year where by the spring we'll have all that complete with picnic tables. And then the next phase will be nature play structures, things for children to climb around on, explore, go under. We're really hoping for a tree house.
I know. I keep pushing for a tree house. I don't think anyone else wants it. What about the liability?
No.
But yeah, we want to have like playground type structures, and there'll be some interpretive signs along the way. We're redoing the plantings. If you look at it right now, it's sort of a construction zone. Yeah. I mean, the heavy equipment is still there. The trail just went in. It just got seeded with some kind of first level seeding. But we're going to be adding native plants, native shrubs, and making it kind of a secret garden play area
Fun.
For kids. And like we said, the picnic tables will be in place. It'll be probably over the course of a couple of years, phasing in the different parts of it. But the trail itself is in, and so we're close on that front.
Yeah, and we have all sorts of different activities. Also, too, in the exhibit hall is also being renovated as well, adding additional bird exhibits. Kind of back to the bird theme. Something that we're so well known for. We'll have a very generous funder who is allowing us to now develop all brand new exhibits focusing on primarily birds to complement the new bird window that we have, and as Mark was mentioning, landscape features. You can see some orange flags out here that are marking some of the invasive species that we're going to be yanking, adding in native plantings to attract birds. We have a brand new water feature that's being developed. You'll see some flags out there that's a kind of a free-flowing to mimic a herring run, a stream. So having moving water will be really incredible for out there for attracting
that's
birds.
That's going to be really cool. Our aquarist came up with that design, and literally a stream with pumps and like reservoir tanks you can't see, but it's just going to look like there's this little herring run that kind of just right outside the bird feeder windows that goes around the corner and down and then disappears. And that's going to be really attractive to the birds that aren't normally attracted to feeders, things like warblers and things like that.
Yeah, so water, big feature. Well, I've told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again since we're here. My grandson had just turned 3 when we were here, he's 4 now, and his first birding excursion, actually out birding, we're out on the trails. At first he was a little worried we might get lost. No, we have a trail map. He had his little binoculars, and that's when he said, I hope I see my best bird. Oh. I thought, oh boy, what's it? I hope it's not a penguin. And I said, what's your best bird? The robin.
Yeah.
And we said, good, we're robin. Good. We'll definitely. So a lot of this is, what kid doesn't like to walk around in nature, right? I mean, it's always a lot of fun.
100%. Yeah. And we have, and we just saw the school group, actually, they very quietly snuck
by.
Yeah,
I saw them going, shh. They were really quiet. Yeah.
I was a little worried, but I can't believe they slipped away without causing a scene.
Yeah. And they got it in before the rain. And you're absolutely right. I mean, getting kids out in the natural world, that is our goal. Getting people out in the natural world, that is our goal. So these exhibits are really, are just a way to enhance, inspire, encourage, but really the true, I feel the true benefit and the true value to this place is the grounds themselves, right? And getting people outdoors to experience.
Yeah. Now, I know that a lot of people worry about ticks and I get it, but sometimes we are keeping ourselves and our kids from nature because of that fear. Do you get people who ask you about that?
Absolutely. I mean, we deal with that with the school groups coming through. Also this year with Eastern Equine Encephalitis was also, kind of brought up. I think one of the things that we really pride ourselves on is that we have an incredible maintenance staff here that keeps our trails very well maintained. And, to your point with your grandson not getting lost, hopefully part of that was not only the trail maps, but also on the trails there are markers telling you how to return. And so we have very well maintained trails, encouraging people and giving them tools and the education in advance to stay on the trails and always, always do tick checks and after you're done.
A little permethrin around the shoes and your pants.
Yeah, that's all you really need to do. And we're worried about that too, people keeping kids and themselves out of nature because of legitimate fears about, getting a chronic illness. But, there are steps you can take. You don't have to stay out of nature. You can manage your yard in a certain way. Stay on the trail. Yeah. This is really not a deer tick place. I didn't get a deer tick the entire season. Certainly some of our dry fields and places like that, you would never get a deer tick anyway. They tend to be in more forested type, like moist forest kind of environments, but just you take precautions. Right. We're not like a tick hot spot.
Yeah,
in
that's
general.
Good to know. All right, let's talk to Renee, who's giving us a call from Nantucket. Hi, Renee.
Hey, Mindy, how are you?
Good.
We were out at my house one time with Vern many years ago, so I had I have one of those active bird feeders. And I'm not sure if someone's asked this question before because I'm a sporadic listener because I am working too. But where have all the goldfinches gone? I used to have, that was the largest population of birds at my feeder, and there are none, and there haven't been since late summer.
Huh.
Who do you ask that question to? Is there a bird guy in the house?
All right, Mr. Bird Guy.
What is this show?
This is Nantucket. Where are the goldfinches? Because we're seeing some goldfinches here. Yeah.
Yeah, they're around. You know, they vary from year to year. People at Cape Cod Bird Club last night were saying the same thing. Some people were saying, I'm not seeing any goldfinches. One of my theories is that, as I talked about in a recent bird report, there's a lot of food for birds up north still. So across the boreal forest, there are the birch crops are very good, alders. These are things that goldfinches will feed on. So I don't know if that's keeping them further north and we haven't seen them yet. I mean, I'm certainly seeing goldfinches, but not
in big numbers.
Yeah, they come and go. Like there was a big influx one day and then the next day they're gone. So they're coming through, but it's a good question. Either they're further north. I don't think it's like a population decline. I mean, it could be. It could be they didn't have a good breeding year, but it just may be that there's more food elsewhere, and so they're not here yet, or they've moved through already.
They were there in the spring, and then they disappeared, which was the unusual thing, because I always keep my feeder is full.
Right. So in the spring, they're a funny bird because they don't breed in the spring. They breed in the summer. So they breed in late summer. They're our latest breeding bird. And so they'll be on seemingly on territory, and males will be singing away in, like, March. And I'm like, what are you doing? You're not going to be breeding until late July. So they're funny birds. And then our local ones might move on. And then, like, this time of year, it's like the robins. We're getting new goldfinches coming in from the north. And maybe they're not in yet. They're, you know, there's lots of things that are responsible for the year-to-year variation. And the robins are doing the same thing right now. Like every morning I go out, let the dog out, and I hear what I call high robins. Mm. You hear these robin flight calls, and they're up high, and they're coming in from further north. You know, our robins left some weeks ago, a couple of months ago, and these robins from Canada are coming in. And so it's similar to goldfinches. You'd see them year-round here, but they're different individuals. Bluebirds are like that. You could see them year-round on the Cape, but who are the ones in the winter? They're probably from further north.
Yeah. Renee, thanks for asking that question, because evidently a lot of people are asking the same question. Appreciate you calling in. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, Melissa, now that you are the new executive director, do you have any kind of vision or goal that is like a top priority for you?
I have lots of visions and lots of goals here. Right now, we're currently just, as you may recall, and perhaps, for the listeners, while I'm new in this role here at the sanctuary,
I'm not new to Mass Audubon
or to the sanctuary, actually entering into my 22nd year here at the sanctuary. Prior to that was the education manager and also working mostly on adult education here on the property. So, right now it's for me, it's understanding and because I have been away for a year. And so returning and coming back and looking at it with through a new lens, right? Mm-hmm. And I think education, of course, is always a goal. We have Mark here with our science department, and the intersection of that is really important. I think one of the things that we, show and demonstrate here is that we focus our education on the things that we really do very well, that we're known for, that we can go deeper and explore deeper with the children. So, for example, bird banding. This is part of, long-term curriculum that we are exploring with them. And after they visit here, so we work with Monomoy Middle School, Grade 7, Nauset Regional Middle School, Grade 7, Provincetown, Grade 7, and today is Harwich, Grade 4, all looking at, birds. And then the older grades, the Grade 7s, they're taking this bird banding data and they're exploring it and trying to understand some trends and things such as that. So taking our science, the citizen science projects that we have, in bringing them to the schools and allowing the students to go deeper. Same thing with sea turtles, same thing with the diamondback terrapin studies that we do. So I want to see us do more of that and refine that and continuing to have that intersection. And like the last caller, Renee, that when the children are outside, they start to recognize patterns, right? Mm-hmm. They like, oh, wait, where is that goldfinch? Oh, I saw the goldfinch. Where are they over the course of the season? Or start to recognize different bird species, how they, you know, use the landscape and things such as that.
And inspire them, as you say, like, to be, you know, lifelong maybe birders or researchers or...
100%.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, you know, too, also my background also is a little bit more diverse in the sense that I have a humanities background, so the science extremely important, but we also interact and engage with the natural world on so many different levels. And I think, you know, bringing you know, as we have done in the past before, but bringing the arts, you know, into this as well, you know, looking at how people are sitting, you know, I'm looking at Mindy right now, and she's sitting in front of a beautiful mural that we have of painted birds, you know, and so, you know, the intersection of the written word, of the, you know, of the paintings, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. Now, are these life size?
No.
No? I was going to say, because that seems really big.
Yeah, it's pretty good, though. Yeah.
You've never seen a cardinal that big, have you? Look, there's one right there.
Yeah, cardinal. Maybe it's a little bit. Well, no, when they puff up in the winter, right? When they puff up in the winter. All right, so also, Mark, we've got the Christmas bird counts coming up.
Christmas bird counts coming up.
They'll be getting underway pretty soon.
Well...
Not a month away.
Like a little over a month. Yeah, so the first ones will be the Buzzards Bay count, which is your neck of the woods. That's the 14th. So that's that first weekend in the middle of December. That's always when that is. And the day after that is the Cape Cod one, which is called that. It's called that like it's the only one, but it's because it's the oldest one. It's like
the first 90 years old
or something like that. And so that one is like Harwich to Eastham, and that's on the 15th. And we're still not sure. I compile the Truro one, and I haven't set a date because I'm waiting to hear on some other counts, including the Mid-Cape.
We'll know next month, though.
You'll know soon. Just keep track of that. It's an exciting time of year.
Yeah. All right. Now, I don't know which one you want to answer this question, but the you mentioned, Melissa, taking out some of the invasives, and in this window over here, we're looking out on the new upgraded pollinator garden, and I know Mark's been working hard at researching what are native and what are not native plants, right?
Yeah, that's been an obsession of mine for a while, pollinator gardening, and... So I came up with the plant list, and we worked with a company called Blue Flax Landscape Design. They did pro bono work on the design. One of the big things I wanted was a pathway through it, because it's a big garden. Mm-hmm. And so now we have this path that goes through and loops around, so you can get up close and personal with all of the different plants. We have formal labels on them now, so you can say, oh, that's I want to try that in my garden. Mm-hmm. And you can see the bees and the butterflies and things visiting the flowers. And so it's a much more intimate experience now. I replaced a lot of things with all natives, kept a few of the kind of standard non-native things that are fine, like salvias and things like that, that are great for bees. But overwhelmingly native plants. And that'll serve as kind of the beginning of our children's nature trail. It's all part of the same thing. So we'd be adding some more of those plants along the trail there. But I recommend coming out, you know, in the spring, some of these things will be blooming. It hits its stride in July and August when it really was just, it was fantastic this year. It was full of monarchs. I mean, it was
Yeah, it was a good year for monarchs, wasn't it? Now, one other thing, Melissa, we didn't mention. We're talking about nature, and we are talking about the nature that we would find here. No pets. Do not bring your pets.
Right, right.
Unfortunately. Sadly. But there's lots of other trails you can bring your pets.
Yeah, right? Mark, when earlier in the beginning of the show, when Mark asked if I, you know, would sing the Sam, white-throated sparrow song, is because my dog is named Sam Peabody. So, you know, poor Sam Peabody.
The mnemonic for their song is old Sam Peabody, Peabody, Peabody.
So yeah. while most of us here at the sanctuary are very pet-friendly, you know, there has to be wild spaces that don't allow animals, right? Don't allow
pets.
Pets.
Yeah, because we are animals.
We are animals.
Get these animals out of here. What are they doing?
And I love, too, that you just, I mean, you leave the dead trees, you really leave the whole ecosystem intact here. And if you haven't been out, it's definitely worth a visit.
Absolutely.
Bring the kids. You have lots of great programs. And we'll have a link to our website, capeandislands.org, to the sanctuary. And also, with that great information about what to do if you find a cold stunned turtle, just a quick reminder, you want to move it above the high tide line, you want to cover it with some seaweed or other debris on the beach, mark the place with debris, and then call the Mass Audubon Wellfleet Bay hotline, and we will have a link to all of that at our website, capeandislands.org. Melissa, thanks so much for being with us, and Mark, we'll see you next month.
See you next
time. Second Tuesday of the month.
Thank you very much.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.